This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, we're looking at human rights as a weapon against terrorism. When might a human rights campaign be more important than a bombing campaign? But first, a recent poll reveals that Americans hold surprising opinions about life in the wake of September 11th. I talked with Richard Morin of The Washington Post and asked him if people believe the nation has truly changed.
Nearly every American believes that the United States has changed as a consequence of September 11th. That isn't a surprise. But what surprised us in our latest survey was that most Americans, a rather healthy majority, think the country has changed for the better.
For the better in what way, Richard Morin?
It's interesting. We went back and we talked to some people we interviewed in the poll, and what we found is that people felt closer to their families. They felt closer to their friends. They thought the incident, as horrific as it was, had brought people closer together. People are even telling us they felt closer and more confident in their government and the way the government and public officials, even the politicians, had responded to the crisis.
So they see it change for the better at the national level and at the personal level?
Both levels. We asked specifically, did it change the country, and did it change the way that you have lived your life or the way you thought about things? And again, a majority of Americans, about 55%, said they personally had been transformed by the events of September 11th.
Did you look at people's outlook for the new year that we're just beginning, 2002? Are they optimistic, pessimistic? What's the pulse?
We did look. We asked both if they felt optimistic about what 2002 would bring to them, and an overwhelming majority said yes. About 8 in 10 said they thought the new year would be good for them. But we also asked them what they thought the future would bring for the world as a whole. We thought that perhaps we'd get a different response, and we did, but not that much different. A somewhat smaller majority, about 6 in 10, said that they were confident about what the next 12 months will bring to the world.
Do you have a baseline to compare those two? How do people normally feel, or how have they normally felt, Americans, at the beginning of a new year? Any idea?
Tom, that's a smart question, and no, we don't. My guess, and it's only a guess, is that people generally feel optimistic, and that these numbers, if anything, might be a bit more pessimistic, slightly less optimistic than in the past, though clearly people are confident about the future. It's something about people in general. We tend to be optimists as much as we journalists tend to be pessimists.
We're turning that around. What about on this optimism front, what about any demographic differences? Did you see that a particular gender or age or political members of a political party were more or less optimistic?
The surprising thing to us was the absence of differences. Blacks and whites, young and old, men and women, everyone felt more optimistic about the future, and also thought that the events of September 11th had generally been good for the country, not bad.
So when they say the country is definitely changed, most of the things that they'd put under that category were positive changes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a bit of a surprise, as I said before, to us. We expected a somewhat a different result. One of my more cynical colleagues suggested, my gosh, what would have happened if an even greater tragedy had occurred? I tend not to be as pessimistic.
There's the journalist talking.
I know. Newsrooms are tough places
Newsroom
to hang
humor.
Out.
Richard Morin, what about the impact that Americans anticipate from the war on terrorism? Are they confident? Do they think it will have an impact on the domestic scene?
Americans do believe it will have an impact, and we asked them if they thought it might reduce spending on necessary domestic programs. And, you know, Americans are pretty smart, and they say, yes, they do expect it will be a cost, and it will be a painful price that we'll be paying, that we aren't going to be able to do some of the things that we really need to do on the domestic front. But we followed that up, do you think that with the question that asked them, do you think that the price was worth it, this additional spending, unanticipated spending on terrorism really was worth it? And the overwhelming majority, Republicans and Democrats, young and old, said, yes, it was worth it.
Richard Morin writes for The Washington Post. The 1980s looked to be a breakthrough decade for human rights. The Cold War ended, and a new spirit of democracy and global responsibility seemed to be spreading throughout the world. But the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989 ushered in a new decade of human rights challenges and failures. Human rights crises in Rwanda, Haiti, Bosnia, and China challenged U.S. hearts and interests. And our next guest says in each situation, despite clear warnings, the American government was caught off guard. Could it be that the 9/11 catastrophe was a human rights failure in disguise? 3,000 Americans clearly lost their rights and lives. But could more focus on human rights in Afghanistan and the Middle East have diffused the attacks, or is that dreaming? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. John Shattuck joins us in the studio tonight. He's CEO of the John F. Kennedy Library and Foundation and former Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the Clinton administration. He's also worked extensively with the American Civil Liberties Union and Amnesty International. He's working on a new book on human rights, Wars of the 90s. John Shattuck, thank you for joining us this evening.
Glad to be here.
And with us is our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening, Jack.
Good evening, John.
John Shattuck, we have been pursuing a war on terrorism with full fury in the last few months, but you've written that it's a mistake to ignore the human rights campaign as a weapon in a campaign against terror. We note that in the aftermath of the war on terrorism and Washington's call for a global crackdown, we're already hearing warnings that things may be going too far. The chief human rights officer at the UN Secretariat told the Council's new counterterrorism committee just days ago, there is evidence that some countries are now introducing measures that may erode core human rights safeguards. We see new measures in Cuba, in Zimbabwe, in Uzbekistan, in Kyrgyzstan, and elsewhere, cracking down on dissidents. So where's the human rights campaign if the war on terror is saying, just keep the lid on everywhere?
Well, I think there's a paradox here. I think on the one hand, there is very clearly the example of Afghanistan, which has bred terror in the worst possible way, and we've seen what the results are, and the American people now see dramatically what the kind of swamp of human rights abuse, brutal discrimination against women, torture, mass killings, intolerance in every respect of freedom of religion. All of that was the swamp out of which the terror sprang that struck New York and that caused such devastation. In order to address that terror, a coalition has been assembled, which is now fighting back and fight quite effectively so in some respects in the Afghan situation, and certainly the liberation of the people of Afghanistan from the terrorist regime that they had. But on the other hand, certainly the alliances that have been formed have meant perhaps less attention is being paid to human rights in many situations. Chechnya, for example, is no longer so much on the screen as a result of the alliance with Russia. The situation in Pakistan, where human rights has long been a real problem crisis area. But I believe, I nonetheless am optimistic, that the American people, and I think your polling is beginning to show this, and are very concerned about issues of rights and recognize that if we're going to attack this problem at its root, and quite rightly President Bush has said that this is a long-term struggle, we've got to really go for the root, and we've got to make sure that we address the kinds of crises that Afghanistan was, that Rwanda was, that Bosnia was, and Chechnya and other situations. And not we alone, of course. This is a global issue, but the United States needs to play a very leading role in this, and I believe we will. I think this is an issue that will get onto the public agenda.
Do you think it's there now? You've played a role for a long time with Amnesty International, with the ACLU, and the Clinton administration as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights. When you listen to President Bush talking about getting at terror at its roots, have you heard in that a call for greater human rights vigilance?
No, and I think right now is a very crucial moment, because I think now that the military issues have been addressed in Afghanistan, it is all the more reason for us to address the longer-term issues. I think there is some evidence that certainly President Bush and his administration are looking at the so-called nation-building challenge in Afghanistan and have made indications that they will support the U.N. efforts in that area. That's something that before September 11th was anathema to certainly President Bush and others who said the United States shouldn't play such a role.
But so, dictators can build nations, too, and I've heard plenty of quips over the last couple of months that suddenly the sine qua non of being a friend of the United States is that you can keep the lid on, however you do it. If you can keep the lid on, you're our pal. Do you see that message getting out into the world?
Well, I think that is a dangerous message, and it is to some extent getting out into the world. And I think that's why the counter message of addressing the human rights crisis at its origins and engaging with countries, not as we did, for example, in Afghanistan, walking away after the Soviets pulled out and allowing the situation to develop into what it was. We also need to build international institutions that can protect human rights, and we've made some progress in that area, but a great deal more needs to be done. The UN is certainly the principal instrument of that, but so are some of the regional organizations. We need to support peacekeeping efforts more effectively than we've been willing to do. It was very difficult, I think, to mobilize public support for the kinds of interventions, humanitarian interventions, that are required today in the wake of 9/11. It was very difficult in the earlier period, and that was why, frankly, I think that the United States was fundamentally caught off guard in Rwanda and Bosnia.
But you seem to be suggesting something even more interventionist here. That is, that we should have gone in or done something more aggressive about Afghanistan. They didn't have a genocide in Afghanistan. They had the social conditions that, as you described them, were really tough. But that we should have somehow intervened on the side of human rights in Afghanistan before all this crisis. You know, the most that we were able to do, as far as I can see, under the Clinton administration was send some cruise missiles in.
Well, intervention comes in many forms. And when we speak of intervention, we're certainly not talking about military intervention in many instances. We're talking about working together with a coalition of countries from a region to address a crisis that is developing in that region. We did not do that in Afghanistan, and we were unable to do that in Rwanda. I think the public support for doing that was not very strong at the time. I certainly think that what's happened after September 11th is that the public is very well aware that a crisis many thousands of miles away that involves human rights abuses could, in fact, strike us right at our own heart, and therefore we better address it.
We're going to have to take some time in the next segment to settle in on what we mean by a crisis. There are an awful lot of countries that you might describe as in a human rights crisis, but that are not in a situation of starvation or of genocide. Jack Beatty, how do you read this? Do you see the Bush administration ready to pull the human rights campaign out of its holster and put it out alongside the military campaign?
Not at all. I mean, because I can see somebody inside the State Department saying to John, look, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, corrupt dictators, we start pressing on human rights and we have instability. Conservatives for 15 years have been invoking the Iran model, you know. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Carter started to talk about human rights, and the next thing you know, you had the embassy seized, you had revolution, you had stability uber alles when we have the threat of terrorism. Isn't that the mantra?
Well, I think we need to separate out some of these issues here. Human rights, you're right, is a kind of a flag that's sometimes waved at the very activists who are trying to advance the cause in a way of trying to back them down. But what we're really talking about here is United States and indeed global attention to situations where there is a disintegration of the state, where a cynical leader has come forward, as in the case of Milosevic, who fans the flames of ethnic conflict and causes people to turn against each other and ultimately genocide occurs. We're sometimes talking about situations in countries that are like Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, where clearly we need to find some moderate leadership who are going to make a difference for civil society.
We're talking tonight with John Shattuck, former ambassador to the Czech Republic, former assistant secretary of state for human rights in the Clinton administration, and we'll talk about that that record as well. The subject is human rights and how effective a weapon that can be against terrorism. Should the U.S. support strong governments that keep order or reform governments that may risk instability for human rights? Join us 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about a human rights campaign as a response to global terrorism. What do you think? Can it work? Is human rights advocacy an effective weapon in the war on terrorism, or would you rather use B-52s and civil clampdowns? Our guest tonight is John Shattuck. He's CEO of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation and a former Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the Clinton administration, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Shattuck, there's so much to talk about. I want to back up to one very simple thing first. Draw the recipe for us. You're making a connection between the absence of human rights and the emergence of terrorism. Describe how that works.
Well, when you have, as we have seen in the last decade, as the forces of disintegration have competed with the forces of integration in the world since the end of the Cold War, you have some states that have completely fallen apart, and you have people like Milosevic or those who carried out a genocide in Rwanda stepping forward and taking charge of those states.
Are you describing those as acts of terrorism?
No. I'm saying that the situation that develops or can develop in a state like that, and we saw it in a paradigm way in Afghanistan, to be sure, can be that this is a very comfortable home for terrorism. And indeed, those who are conducting crimes against humanity and genocide could just as easily decide to take their campaigns abroad and might well do so. So that's the connection. And I think that's what Americans are beginning to see as they come to understand this reporting that's coming out of Afghanistan that shows that terrible conditions that befell the people of Afghanistan when the Taliban moved in and took over.
So the American people were clearly ready to go in and do something about Afghanistan after 9/11, after the terrible price that was paid there. Do you see a readiness in either the government or the public to pursue a more rigorous human rights campaign now as an antidote to terrorism? Can you see the U.S. Public supporting, you name the kind of effort that goes into, you name the country. Give us an example of where it might work, where it might be important to pursue.
Well, I mean, let's take a country like Haiti, which is 90 miles off the coast of the United States, and where there was indeed a tremendous human rights crisis and continues to be a serious problem. But the human rights situation is indeed much, much better as a result of an intervention that took place in 1994. It was quite an unpopular intervention in that there was very little public support for it. The public probably supported more crackdown on refugees and trying to turn people away. I think today people would be more willing to support what President Clinton did in 1994 than perhaps was the case at the time. I happen to think that that was quite a heroic effort on his part. There were other times when I think the Clinton administration fell very far short, as in Rwanda and Bosnia, for example.
Jack Beatty, do you see that readiness in the populace even after 9/11 to draw the line that John Shattuck draws between terrorism and an absence of human rights and saying we have to go out there and assure human rights around the world or we're even more vulnerable?
I just to agree with John, I think it takes the leadership. We have to have a president who can do what President Bush has yet to demonstrate, and that is to talk to the people, to persuade, to go beyond the headlines and to see the larger picture. There's been a chariness about even talking about root causes here for fear that we're seeming to legitimate what happened to us and for fear of making this sound like social work. But I quite agree that the public has got the attention now that of people. Afghanistan is a paradigm. We see what instability can lead to. And I just hope that – but, you know, isn't it something? The first response the Bush administration makes is to go to military tribunals, which is precisely what we complained about in Egypt, in Burma, in Peru. It's as if the Bush government didn't realize what our real advantage is here.
Yeah, I mean,
and this makes me terribly unoptimistic about what's to come.
No, I think the tragedy is that so far our response at home, particularly, has been not a terribly good example to the world about what we mean about human rights. Now, that does not mean that law enforcement shouldn't very aggressively pursue those who are engaged in terrorism and prosecute them to the full extent of the law and investigate them fully. But military tribunals, which we've systematically over the recent years disapproved of in our human rights reports, are clearly not something that are consistent with either our own view of human rights or the way the world looks at us.
Here's the question. Is the urgency of the war on terror, in the urgency of the war on terror, do we have time for human rights? Is human rights advocacy the weapon of dreamers or of realists? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Josh is on the line. Welcome, Josh. You're on the air.
Well, hi. This is Josh Rubenstein. I'm the regional director of Amnesty International in town.
Welcome.
I want to call to people's attention. Just today in the Boston Globe, there was a very disturbing, though brief, article that in Saudi Arabia, one of our closest allies now in this war against terrorism, they just executed three people for being gay. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that Saudi Arabia has the kinds of repression that we're familiar with in Afghanistan, where people have their limbs amputated, where there are summary executions, where they execute people for crimes that we would not even recognize, like being gay, or we have evidence that someone was executed for the crime of sorcery.
What should we do about that? What should the United States do about that?
Well, it seems to me we can't have it both ways, which is what we're trying to do. We're trying to say that, yes, we want to oppose regimes that support terrorism, and yet in the case of Saudi Arabia, where we know they were in support of Osama bin Laden, the U.S. has been very reluctant to criticize Saudi Arabia forthrightly. And at the same time, in other countries like Uzbekistan and Pakistan, we seem to be blinking all the more at their internal repression just so that in the short run, we can have their cooperation.
Josh, hang on. Let's put that to John Shattuck. And John Shattuck, we know you're a former ambassador, but don't be diplomatic with us. We've got a real problem here as a nation. What do we do about it?
Well,
take Saudi Arabia.
I take Saudi Arabia and Uzbekistan, two very important cases which Josh is pointing to. I think the role that we are now playing in addressing terrorism in Afghanistan should give us much more leverage in both Uzbekistan and Saudi Arabia.
Are you suggesting that Saudi Arabia fears we might come in and do the same thing to them?
No,
well,
that's not what I'm saying.
So where's
no,
the leverage?
No. But I am saying that Saudi Arabia fears the terrorism. And certainly we all know that bin Laden was as clearly targeting Saudi Arabia as he was anything else. And Uzbekistan itself is concerned about that. And I think we now need to use our leverage and we need to make contact with moderates in these countries. We've so far been unwilling to do that. We've tended to stay almost entirely with the regimes. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about since 9/11 in particular. We need to support civil society. We need to find and develop moderate leadership. I think what's happening now in Iran, which is certainly a very dynamic and complicated situation, where Khatami has emerged as a somewhat moderate leader in that context. We need to find a diplomacy that can better encourage the Khatami wing.
Let me ask you, in Saudi Arabia, can you imagine a third secretary from the embassy in Saudi Arabia driving out to have lunch with someone that the royal Saud family considered a dissident?
No, but I think that's something that we ought to start doing. And
it shows how far we are from the policy.
True.
We won't even drive out and have lunch with that person.
No, and I will give an example of something that we do in other countries, and I've been directly involved in this. In China, for example, despite the very great hostility of the Chinese government to our engaging with dissident forces in that country, I think we do, and I've done that certainly as Assistant Secretary of State. We need to do that more in these countries that you're talking about and that Josh has raised, because right now I totally agree with him. Our standard is a very double standard, and it's not helping us either in the war on terrorism or in promoting human rights.
Josh, what kind of steps would you like to see taken by the United States government?
Well, let me make one other point that's not directly connected to this current crisis. You know, Mr. Bush was very involved in dealing with the new president of Mexico on issues of trade and immigration. Mm-hmm. But since 9/11, we have virtually neglected Mexico altogether, where there is a brewing crisis, because here we are a year into Mr. Fox's administration, and we've had this terrible murder in Mexico City of a leading woman lawyer who was dealing with some prisoners Amnesty was concerned about. And this puts Mr. Fox to the test. Is he really a reformer? Is he going to take on issues in Mexico relating to disappearances and torture and the role of the army? Or are we going to have business as usual in Mexico? And what will that mean for the future? And it seems to me one fallout of the attack on September 11th is that if an issue in foreign affairs is not directly connected to the crisis, the U.S. will be oblivious to it, will ignore it. And in the long run, this can also have very bad effects for us.
Josh Rubenstein, thank you so much for your call and for raising these cases. John Shattuck, we hear and we can only imagine the list that Amnesty International has of abuses around the world, and then that raises the thought, is this some kind of utopian dream? Can we really address all this?
Well, I think people may have looked at it that way before September 11th, but the argument that I'm making, and it's a very simple, straightforward, practical argument, which is that we can no longer blink at parts of the world and say they aren't really problems for the United States because they're far away, when in fact they are, and I'm not saying there are huge numbers of places like this where they are the breeding grounds for terrorism. That does not mean we should go and militarily intervene around the world, certainly not unilaterally, but it does mean that we should spend more on our foreign aid budget. It means that we should address ways of finding moderates in countries in the way that I was talking about in China. We should encourage dissident movements in the situation where there is, in fact, a dictator in charge. This is all very much in our national interest, and this is something that I think has become more evident since September 11th. I'm so far disappointed with the Bush administration's approach toward the human rights aspect of this, particularly in the United States, where I think military tribunals send exactly the wrong signal around the world.
Not inside the United States, but as part of U.S. policy.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Jack Beatty, you know, we've sat here week after week and heard a tremendous range of prescriptions for U.S. foreign policy going forward. Everything from get the heck out of these situations, come home America, to this, which is, if you really take it seriously, is an intensely interventionist kind of posture toward the world. Do you see an American mindset open to this?
Well, you know, we had Stanley Hoffman on the program a few weeks ago, and he put it in a phrase. He said, today, idealism is the only form of realism. And by that he meant that we need to, our problems particularly, I mean, that the terrorism came from Egypt and Saudi Arabia by way of Afghanistan. So those three countries, well, Afghanistan is off the board. That leads these other two countries. What is in our long-term interest? Is it to support these regimes as an end in itself so that they continue to you know, export their terrorists? They have no domestic politics. Or is it to somehow say to those regimes, look, Egypt, we give you $2 billion a year, and yet you are effectively preventing politics, and you're preventing Islamists from even getting into politics, so that we can't even test the proposition that they may be moderate, democratic-friendly Islamists. You won't let them in. If you want that aid, you got to do that. We could say to Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia, you know, we protect you. Absent us, Saddam takes the oil fields. Look, you've got to have some opposition here. You've got to have some politics or the golden. That would be our long-term practical interest. But, of course, to the Bush administration, I'm afraid that would sound like woolly idealism, trying to reform the domestic. But it's those domestic conditions that produce the terrorism.
And Jack,
our enemy.
Jack, let's remember that the Clinton administration was no more aggressive in those terms.
We ran a piece in the Atlantic Monthly that was a devastating indictment of the Clinton policy toward Rwanda, which was...
I know it very well.
Yeah.
I know the policy.
Which you fought, and which, of course, Bill Clinton just said, take this cup away from me. So, no, I'm not being partisan. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I think you know, I don't want to take too far back a view on this, but, I mean, we've got to recognize that for a decade after the end of the Cold War, the United States, Americans generally, thought that the world was more or less safe for them. And that what they needed to focus on was things at home, particularly the economy. They did very well in that regard. Clinton, in fact, responded to the wishes of the American people in that regard. However, the dramatic events of September 11th have fundamentally changed that. And now we need to look back at some of these very things that you're talking about, Rwanda, Bosnia, Haiti, our relations with China, many other countries, and say, wait a minute. What did we not do, or what did we do that was wrong that created the situation that we're in now?
John Shattuck, a lot of people want to join us. Let's turn to the phones. Peter's on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes. I wanted to say that I thought that poverty as a root cause of terrorism was a very unlikely candidate, given the various people from the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and elsewhere who seem to be remarkably well off. Mm-hmm. And I think one ignores the influence of ideology. Everyone is tiptoeing around and avoiding the subject of what precisely is in the Quranic teachings that might provide a prism through which people who are unhappy for various reasons, political, personal, other reasons, have a worldview that views the infidel and the leader of the infidel world as responsible for all of their ills.
Peter, are you suggesting that if the United States embraces human rights, it must necessarily oppose Islam? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that there ought to be some discussion about the elements of political Islam. I mean, there's people who go and, you know, buy a book off the shelf that tells them about the five pillars of religious worship and what is halal and what haram, mm-hmm. may be missing the point. They should, in fact, investigate the doctrine that is taught in Saudi schools, but that is also in the Quran, that a Muslim should never befriend a Christian or a Jew, much less a polytheist. This is in the surahs. I mean, this is not something that the Saudis plucked and made up out of whole cloth.
It's right. Peter, I think we've got your point. Yeah. Let's put it to John Shattuck, and we thank you for it. Thank you for calling, John Shattuck. What about it? What about when what we perceive as human rights violations treads very closely close to the cloak of religion in another country?
Well, we've got to be very clear about what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the export of American culture.
Well, are we
in
not?
Fact, in many ways,
the Saudis would say that, hey,
no.
this is the way we do justice.
Yeah, but we are talking about certain fundamentally recognized, widely recognized fundamental values which have to do with basic life and the way life is protected.
But it's not always that simple, is it? I mean, Josh called earlier and said, look, they've just killed three people for being gay in Saudi Arabia. Well, does that fall within our view of what's not fundamentally allowed?
No, I think the issue here, let's stick with the point about terrorism. The connection that I'm drawing here is between crimes against humanity, mm-hmm. which are massive attacks on civilians and a way of keeping civilians in a horrendous condition of servitude insofar as they can't even live in any way, even within their own culture. That is a breeding ground for terrorism. What we're not talking about is exporting or providing for some kind of universal general values that are not human rights core issues like life.
Listeners, do you buy that distinction? Would we have done anything about Afghanistan by that definition? Does it take a Rwanda for us to get involved at a human rights level? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with John Shattuck, former Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with John Shattuck, Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library and former Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights. Also with our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. The conversation tonight is about human rights and its place in the war on terror. Is the urgency, in the urgency of the war on terror, do we have time for human rights? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line. Welcome, John.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
Good. It's funny. I was going to talk about military tribunals, but you got my interest going in a different direction all of a sudden.
All right, we're with you.
And that's with regard to, why I love this country so much, the country that they're in, America. Mm-hmm. And I love it because it primarily is founded based not on religion, but based on equality. And that everybody has the right to pursue their own religious freedoms. And I guess what I kind of dislike a little bit in the governments or some of the governments in the Middle East is that many of them are founded on the premise of religion. And whether it's Islam or other nations in the Middle East, I don't find that they basically embody what I've grown to love and trust in this country. And although military tribunals and other issues are great issues to debate, I find that the primary debate is what countries do we really want to support going forward, and how and what countries do we say are truly democratic or not?
Well, you're right, John. The Quran is the constitution of Saudi Arabia. But does that mean that we can't be an ally or a friend of Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think if they exclude then other religious groups from participating equally in their country, it doesn't seem like a country that I'd want to support.
John, thanks for your call. Let me put it to John Shattuck. What about this? Here we have a fellow citizen who's looked at the events since 9/11 and said, you know what, I just don't feel comfortable breaking bread with countries who don't exercise our kind of tolerance.
Well, religious freedom is, in fact, a human right. And religious freedom in a situation where a government is telling you that you cannot exercise that your own religion is clearly non-existent. So I think your caller has got a very important point. And indeed, not only Saudi Arabia, but a number of other countries around the world are severe abusers of religious freedom. I think we're talking here about ways of encouraging or in some cases trying to persuade through means that are more coercive countries to go ahead and support more religious freedom. This means, I think, in the case of some of the Middle East countries that we're talking about, much more contact with those who would like to engage in greater religious freedom. I don't think we should go ahead and take on a government that is predominantly or overwhelmingly Islamic simply because of that. But what we should do is try to persuade the Saudis that a Christian group in Saudi Arabia ought to be able to quietly exercise its own freedom of religion, just as indeed we've made the same point with the Chinese about religious freedom in China, where recently three Christians were executed by the Chinese. Mm-hmm. And I think I hope the United States has made a very strong protest on that.
John, let me ask you something that seems to me to lie behind a lot of these questions. You've described the link between an absence of human rights and the breeding of terrorism. We've got a very big, crowded planet, and significant parts of it are poor, and significant parts are angry. Is there a tipping point? Is there a point at which going for order is the only choice, that the human rights path just leads to chaos?
Yes, I'm sure there is, but I would put it not so much as a tipping point as a connection between a policy which calls for greater human rights through various persuasive means, and another policy which actually calls for in some situations military intervention to try to force out a dictator such as Milosevic when human rights are being overwhelmed. And I think there is, in fact, a connection between the two. And for that reason, I'd prefer to look at it that way than as to whether or not there's a situation where in every instance we're going to go for security. We're going for security and human rights, and they are intimately connected.
John Shattuck, the time has gone by quickly. We thank you very much for joining us tonight. John Shattuck is Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation. He's a former Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, was U.S. Ambassador to the Czech Republic, was Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Office, and he's currently writing a book on human rights wars of the 90s. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beatty, wow, what a big vista John has opened up for us here tonight. If we really have to dive in with both hands to get on top of human rights around the world, and yet things seem to be going just the opposite way. I see in an L.A. Times story here, Michael Posner, executive director of the New York-based Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, saying, we are going to see repeated examples of governments using the new security environment as a pretext for silencing dissidents. This gives a green light to the Mugabes of the world to go after their opponents under the cover of what the U.S. and the U.K. are doing to fight terror.
Yeah, his Human Rights Watch talking about an assassination on December 22nd of a leading human rights defender in Chechnya, and they say it looks like an effort to silence those who would expose Russian human rights abuses. He was killed right near a Russian checkpoint. So this is very parallel to the situation Josh Rubenstein was
And yet, Jack, we needed Russia's help on the front Afghanistan
That's
and Al-Qaeda.
That's right. This is a very paradoxical situation, and some people have said, look, in World War II, we embraced the worst violator of human rights in history, the Soviet Union, in order to defeat the second worst, or maybe who knows how to Hitler, and this evil. And maybe we're in a situation like that again. But you read something like this and you say, well, eventually, of course, the people in Chechnya are going to want some reckoning. I mean, and wouldn't it be nice if we are not always on the side of the regimes, that we're able to send a signal to the peoples as well, look, we are on your side too. We're going to have to go slow, but we want what you want.
Of course, we haven't always been on the side of oppressive regimes. I mean, there are many instances with China for years. We battered on China to be better on human rights, especially after Tiananmen.
Yes, but of course, the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton, ran on a policy of doing that and then reversed himself for economic reasons a couple of years into his term. And, you know, the human rights situation in China, by everything I read, has only deteriorated. So it's a complicated matter, but with short-term and long-term there. But, boy, you read these things and you know where your sympathies lie with people who are being oppressed by vicious governments.
They sure are. Well, we're into a new year with a lot to chew on. Thank you, Jack, for being with us.
Thank you.
You can read John Shattuck's essay, The Future of Human Rights, online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage and continue this conversation by clicking on Forums. For the first time in 5 years, music was once again heard on the streets of Kabul soon after the Taliban's defeat. And the first piece to be played on Radio Afghanistan was this song, Kabul Jaan, by the great Afghan pop musician Farhad Darya. Fitting selection. Not only did its lyrics reflect the years of suffering in Afghanistan, but its performer has been Afghanistan's most popular musician, both before the Taliban and in exile over the past 10 years. Now living in Virginia, I asked Farhad Darya what it was like to have his song chosen as the first music to be heard again in his native land.
I learned that my people chose my music to express their five-year extinguished voice through it. My music is a rich rainbow of shared values for Afghans that everyone, even enemies and foes, could listen to it together. This is exactly what I've struggled for, to create a communication between every single side and every individual in Afghanistan through my music. So when I learned that it happened through my music, it was a big honor.
It must have been. What are some of the lyrics of that song for Hadaya?
If you translate it, it would be kind of beloved Kabul. Let me sing limitless songs for the agony of the Afghans, for my homeless, wandering people. Let me sing from Iran down to Pakistan. Do you have a trip towards Kabul or not, oh my beloved? Do you want to make a journey towards your lover or not, oh my beloved? I'm going to die of the pain of my eagerness. Do you have any news of the miserable state of mind or not, oh my beloved?
It's beautiful, Farhad Darya. You're about 40 now, so you've seen many chapters of tough history in Afghanistan. What was it like being a musician? What was the music scene in Afghanistan like before the Taliban?
Before Taliban, music was not that injured. Actually, a time before the communist regime, the music was an open element. It was free, as free as everyone could do anything with it.
Mm-hmm. And during the communist regime, when there was resistance to the Soviets eventually, was the music scene lively then?
Exactly, yeah. The music was quite pushed to do something,
mm-hmm.
stand next to the regime or oppose it.
And then during the chaotic period of the Mujahideen rule, what was it like?
At the beginning, they was kind of friendly to the music. Even they started to broadcast my music. But after a while, they were not that friendly with the music, and everything changed in a different ways. It was not that cruel like the Taliban's time.
How did they threaten you at that time? You actually left in 1990.
They've been experiencing so many threats, even like being shot by an unknown person from a military base close to the Red Afghanistan building, and
wow.
really kicked out more than five times from the university.
Before you left Kabul?
Yes, yeah. I didn't want to leave Afghanistan. I needed my people, my home, and my fellow Afghans needed me. Mm. But one day I realized that I don't have any chance anymore to record and to produce my albums inside of Afghanistan. Asli watan Afghanistan de, asli watan Afghanistan de. Os me nasib prad mulko ki de maina wae yaar maina.
Farhad Darya, you have a song on one of your latest albums called Afghanistan. What do the lyrics of that song speak of?
This is in Pashto. I sing in a couple of different languages, Pashto, Farsi, Uzbek, Hazaragi. And so this song, it says that the homeland is Afghanistan. The original source is Afghanistan. The original address is Afghanistan. But right now we are spread all around the universe.
As a musician, what is your mission now, Farhad Darya?
Actually, I have had three missions. First, during the time of the resistance, I was trying to awake the patriotism. The second mission started from my exile from 1990 up to now, is to recall the Afghan nation to unify them. And the last mission, which started kind of from 2000, is to recall the world, to redefine my fellow Afghans, my Afghanistan, in a different way, in a new way. As I see, as the world know, when they think about Afghanistan, they see only bloody faces, only dusty deserts, only weapons, only killing each other, only trouble, and only sorrow. This is not our original face.
When do you think you'll return to Afghanistan?
As soon as I feel that I could survive as a free human being first, and then as a free musician.
And how close do you feel you are to that point with Afghanistan now?
We don't lose our hope. This is the only thing we could carry. But since our past telling us something else, it's warning us to be highly alert this time, because the passing cheer-ups are not able to take us to the happy end. So this time we must be careful not to have the same mistake again. But still, we're hopeful.
We wish you luck.
Thank you.
Farhad Darya is an Afghan singer currently living in Virginia. You can find out more about him and his music by going to our website at wbur.org and clicking on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is WBUR.